Tansei Bojo. This is At the Edge of Canada with TJ Phillips, bringing you weekly check-ins with all the major players in the Indigenous intellectual community throughout southern Manitoba and across the country. This week's show, we're going to keep it in-house. Big things happened this weekend. It was a tough weekend if you were in Indian country. If you're a member of the community, if you're an ally of the community, it was a tough weekend. Friday night, as I fade out in the Hiwok, there are opening for this season. This is season 2.2, episode 6 of At the Edge of Canada. We are live today, and we're live today because of the enormity of this weekend's events, the acquittal of Gerald Stanley, and the lack of hashtag justice for Colton Bushy. It was a topic of conversation between me and many members of my immediate community and my circle here in Winnipeg, not to mention my family back home in Alberta. And I talked to a ton of folks involved in this. Some of us close to the family as you can get, and some of us who spend most of our time intellectualizing these things and talking them out analytically. And to do that, I thought I would actually bring one of my colleagues here at the University of Manitoba on the show, including somebody I consider a friend, one of the newest faculty members here at the University of Manitoba in Native Studies, somebody very popular on social media in Indian Twitter, and that's Dallas Hunt. Dallas, thanks for being on.
Thanks, Trevor. Thanks for having me.
I always like to give people the opportunity to introduce themselves in their language, and I know that you are a speaker of the Cree language. And so I'd love to hear you introduce yourself in Cree, if that's cool.
Sure. So, Tansa Nita Temtek, Dallas Hunt Nitsagasan, Ni Oma Neheo Egwa Wapasusipi Otsania. So, hi, I'm Dallas Hunt. I'm Cree, and I'm from Swan River First Nation, which is in Treaty Territory in northern Alberta.
Not to be mistaken with the Swan River in Manitoba.
Correct, yes.
Which you always have to tell people here that it's not this Swan River, but Swan River AB, not MB. Thank you for coming on the show. Well, let's do a little check-in with you and where you're at since you got here. You've been on the ground, boots on the ground in the Red River Valley since January 1st. Was that the day you got here?
Yeah. No, I got here December 28th, I'm going to say, right in the middle of that cold snap.
Oh, right, so right. Minus 50.
Winnipeg embraced me with open arms.
So. It isn't proper if you don't get a chilly welcome. I think it was about minus 35 when I landed in February 2016. Since you've been on the ground now, you have a lot of work ahead of you, not to mention you're completing your dissertation through the University of BC, but you also have a teaching mandate. What courses are you teaching right now?
Right now I'm teaching an introductory Native Studies course, so Native 1240, I believe. NATV 1240 is the course code, and that's an introduction to Native peoples within Canada. I'm also teaching Native 2000, which is contemporary Indigenous scholarship.
Cool. And how are those classes going so far?
They're going great. One of the joys of being in Winnipeg for me is I'm from the prairies, so from Alberta, where when you grow up in the prairies, there's a high likelihood that you're going to see a lot of Indigenous communities and peoples just in your everyday life. So, which is not to say that when I was in Vancouver recently that there were no Indigenous peoples there. Communities, of course, there are. But in Winnipeg, you really are confronted with Indigenous bodies and spaces, and it's just a great thing to see.
Yeah, it was one of the things I noticed, too, right away coming back from southern Ontario is just the Indigenous population is so high in this province. It's awesome to see, Nietzsche's in all sectors is what I like to say. As for your work itself, you're trained as a lit scholar. I'm sure you've been asked this before, but could you give me the elevator speech of what you work on proper?
I love this question, Trevor. Thanks for asking it. I look at a variety of things. So my research looks at urban indigeneity a little bit. So I think what I try to do is look at the urban as a productive lens through which to look at everything from nationhood to gender relations to kinship relations to just, how that manifests in a sort of colonial how colonial violence manifests over time in a variety of spaces, but specifically in urban environments. I also look at kinship relations in Treaty 8 territory. And Yeah, I'm going to stop there.
It could probably keep going. And one of the reasons why I wanted you on the show is precisely for that little little snippet, how colonial violence manifests itself over time. And we're going to get to that when we dig in a little bit deeper into some of the historical and biopolitical reasons as to why Gerald Stanley got an acquittal in that trial. Before we set the groundwork on that, I just want to let people know that you can check Dallas out on Twitter. Dallas, what's your Twitter handle?
I believe it's just my name, so Dallas underscore Hunt.
And he does Cree Word of the Day. That's where his social media cachet comes from, right? Is that what launched you into the superstrata, other than trolling LeBron James or any other famous basketball players?
I wouldn't troll LeBron. I stand for LeBron. Basically what happened was I joined Twitter because I was interested in the discussions that were going on there and all the wonderful creative sort of vibrant discussions and people, and it just was a great place to encounter other Indigenous peoples from across not only Canada but globally as well. And what I started to do was I just started to I'm not a fluent language speaker, but it's something that I aspire to and hope to someday become. So what I started to do is just tweet a word of the day for myself. I'd say it 5 to 10 times, write it down 5 to 10 times, and then after that I would tweet it. And then what happened was, people started to just take an interest in that. So.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the first places I saw your Twitter was on Cree Word of the Day. And it's always a fun one to retweet. It's usually topical, too. There's usually something that you retweet out, some word that makes sense. I think for LeBron James, you had, was it crying or to cry was the Cree word that you were?
Yeah, it's a motto. And it was after he won the finals, the
right.
Championship, he was hugging somebody and crying, and seemed appropriate.
That was appropriate. It was good, and you're always usually spot on with those tweets. All right, so I talked to you. We hung out for Saturday night. We were texting about this on Friday. We chatted about this yesterday and before we came on air. The acquittal of Gerald Stanley in his second-degree murder trial for the murder of Colton Bushy. If you're not familiar with the details of this case, we're going to work backwards from where we're at today. Where we're at today is Gerald Stanley was acquitted on Friday. On Saturday, there was multiple actions throughout Canada, protests in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Calgary, including some reserves. I know OCN held a protest in action. I'm sure there were other spaces that had it. And then today, after Sunday, after a day of coffee and contemplation, it seemed now every intellectual that we have in Indian country is starting to weigh in on this. Politicians have started to speak about it. There was a document released in which you were undersigned in by academics on the prairies that were basically a call to action on how to teach this moment. So where we're at today is we are processing these feelings, and we're processing how it felt on Friday. I know folks who, for example, Dallas, I know one of my close colleagues was at a wedding and said, I'm just not going to think about this until after this wedding so I can deal with how I feel about all of this. And now it's Monday after it's Monday morning, and we're talking about all of these different things. Robert Jago's written about it. We've seen multiple tweets. Where do you feel like this is at? I one of the words I heard you say before we went on air was it feels overwhelming almost to see all of the content coming out that's trying to analyze the verdict and what this means for Indigenous non-Indigenous relations, what it means for reconciliation. How are you feeling right now with just all of this knowledge being shared and all these critiques coming out?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. There are a lot of incisive, very good pieces out there, analyses. But you're right, there has been a sort of, after the verdict came down, there's been a sort of prolonged, or seems to be from the minute the verdict came down, engagement with what had gone on in the case. And it is overwhelming in the sense that we're getting more details as we have throughout the trial, but also that it's a thing that I think affectively affects a lot of people in ways that are both intellectual, of course, mm-hmm. but also in ways that are emotional and psychological and just all of these other sort of attachments or entanglements that kind of associate themselves with these things. So when I said it was overwhelming, I was speaking to not only the sheer amount of information, some of it is misinformation, of course, but also the sort of affective or emotional responses that are just kind of pouring out from Indian country, and also the affective responses that are coming from non-Indigenous peoples in the prairies especially. And most of those are vile and racist and hateful. And they're a lot to deal with, for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. The negative and the not constructive contributions that some folks are making in some mediums is not advancing this conversation in any way. As an instructor and your responsibility to your students here at the University of Manitoba, what's your tact? How are you going to teach this? How are you going to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, luckily I have very amazing students, some of whom have already emailed me about this issue and requested that we do talk about it in class today and tomorrow and the days I teach this week. So we're probably going to use some of the readings that I assigned to help contextualize this a little bit. But I also plan to, you know, hold a bit of a forum and just see how people are dealing with this, what their reactions are, what are some of the reactions they're seeing, and how do they feel about those reactions. Just really allowing space for students, and many of whom are Indigenous youth from the prairies and feel directly, you know, affected by this. Just giving them some room to speak and, you know, vent.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of a cautious discussion, a cautious platform for seeing what kind of visceral responses you might even get from students who may just be for the first time in your class negotiating or processing the theoretical relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in this country, which I always find is an incredibly vulnerable site of intellectualizing. I don't think we put enough, I personally, this is just opinion, I don't think we put enough time and energy as instructors into just how precious that moment is when some Indigenous and some non-Indigenous students are contemplating this relationship for the first time through the filter of something as enormous as a murder trial.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, I had to come keep coming back to this word, but it is overwhelming, and I can't imagine not only what the family of Colton Bushy are going through, but also, you know, what students who are a similar age to Colton and, you know, live in or on the prairies and have these interactions, how they feel, how this... You know, I've heard comments such as, you know, this feels like it's open season for, you know, violence enacted against Indigenous peoples. And for Indigenous youth particularly, who seem to be the site of a lot of colonial violence, it's definitely an area of very real and very material concern. And so, I'm just trying to host a site wherein my students can speak about this in ways that allows them to express that, and also to figure out sort of how we got here. How do we get to this trial, this murder, this case? What are the conditions that sort of subtend these things? And so, you know, part of my job, or what I would like to do in my classroom, is kind of see if we can trace a sort of, it's not exactly linear, but there is a sort of, you know, there's a story or a narrative at work here. And just to try to parse that out.
The other calls that we've been hearing, and I'll use this as a segue as we move backwards in happenings and in goings-on since the verdict came down, is folks like Leanne Simpson and Cataract Wednesday Dam saying, take care of students right now. Be mindful of their processing, because this is an incredibly vulnerable time for Indigenous youth, especially, who are going through this process of trying to understand what just happened. We're going to talk about the visceral components of what it felt like Friday night to hear the news. And then we're going to also talk about some of the larger implications of settler colonial biopolitics. This is At the Edge of Canada on UMFM 101.5. I am TJ Phillips in studio today, live for you with one of the newest faculty members here at the University of Manitoba in Native Studies, Dallas Hunt. We have been gifted the time to go to the top of the hour by station manager Jared McKediak today to talk about this really important issue. So I thank him for that space and allowing us to preempt your campus today if you were tuning in for that. So if we're working backwards from Friday, and really if we're working backwards from, say, contact on the prairies, then what happened on Saturday in this city was a special moment of organizing and social justice mobility in the city, as there was a meeting at the Forks and then a march to the law courts. You happened to be there. I was calling hockey on UMFM, so I couldn't get there right away. I didn't get there till later. Didn't try to get there till later. But you were here. We had you had friends in town as well that were visiting. Tell me about how it felt to take part in that action and that gathering that happened at the Forks for Colton.
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing turnout for sure. So when the verdict was announced, I was out. I'm a basketball fan, but I was actually at a hockey game. Mm-hmm. With a friend, and it just came in on our cell phones, and you know, it kind of cast a pall all over, you know, over the whole kind of proceedings, which you know was understandable. And but the sheer amount of organizing that went on from the moment that sort of that verdict was announced to the very next day was incredible, and I think it speaks to the way in which, you know, Indigenous peoples felt about this trial. I think it also spoke to the way in which Indigenous peoples were somewhat expecting an outcome like this. And so everybody was quick to mobilize. The turnout was great, and there were speakers, everybody, extending their support and solidarity for the Bushi, Baptiste, and Tutusis families. We marched to the courthouse, and it was great. It was a vibrant place of solidarity, of rage, of love. And it was a sight to behold.
Yeah, I was on Twitter all Friday night after the verdict dropped, after I got back from calling hockey, looking to find out when Winnipeg's news was going to drop. Was seeing Ottawa, Saskatoon, Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, Victoria, all of these places where protests were going to happen. I think it was Monique Woroniak from WPL was the first one I saw tweet out the exact location. I think Negan Sinclair was on that as well. But it was Erica Violet Lee, who's from Saskatoon, and who was tweeting out all of the points on the hashtag Justice for Colton Bushi through that tag. Yesterday, we were intellectualizing a little bit about what social media does to this process, and I had said to you, I felt echoes of Idle No More in this quick organizing. And we were thinking through the ways in which that pulse is still alive and how it can ignite so quickly to organize very fast. The verdict came down, 7:30 our time, 8:30 our time Friday night. By 2 p.m. the next day, we had 1,000 people marching down Broadway Street. The question I have for you is a little bit more analytical, though. The question I have for you is, why is protest so important for Indigenous and non-Indigenous allies in the wake of this verdict? Why do you think it's so important that we did go out to march? What does that do for social justice?
Yeah, I think that's a huge question and an important question. I think it does a variety of things. I think it allows people to register the sort of immense rage and grief and sense of injustice that Indigenous peoples are feeling about a verdict such as this. I think that it lets them know that, this is not okay, and that Indigenous peoples and communities are not okay with this violence continuing, you know, unabated, and that even the act of walking in the streets of Winnipeg is a radical action. Taking up space, stopping traffic, these are all things that, you know, assert that Indigenous peoples are here, and they're very much continue to be here and will be here into the future. And so a protest with that, I think, hopefully allows people that are maybe not sympathetic to these issues or to Indigenous peoples more generally. It's my hope, and I'm sure the hope of many, that these protests allow them to register kind of, you know, Indigenous vibrancy and vitality in life. And especially in a time when, you know, these very same peoples are a part of or perhaps complicit in a system that is so heavily invested in Indigenous death.
It is a striking juxtaposition from the acquittal of the murder of Colton Bushy to the immediate organization and activity and action of Indigenous folks. You're right. That is a completely stark juxtaposition. And the actions are so important because it reminds me of the way in which folks rallied to Trump being elected or rallied to Canada 150, how that there needs to be a peaceable or peaceful resistance to actions that can't be stopped. Even with perceivably democratically elected processes, that there needs to be a way for the moral majority to voice its opinion. And in this particular instance, this model, this theater, marching down Broadway or any other street towards law courts especially, I was curious what you thought about that as a symbol, as folks marching from spaces of intersection to spaces of the judicial system.
Yeah, I mean, it was very fraught, the entire kind of proceedings. I should say that the organizers and the speakers that were at the march did say that this was a march of peace and love for Indigenous peoples themselves, but for non-Indigenous allies who, you know, support the Bushy family and Indigenous peoples more generally. So I think part of what a protest can do is allow people like that to also voice their discomfort or displeasure with a system that allows for these things to happen. So there were a lot of non-Indigenous allies or accomplices or whatever you would call them at the march as well. As to the kind of spatial configuration of it, it was quite interesting to be surrounded by so many Indigenous peoples, to hear, you know, singing, the drum, and just, you know, outbursts of anger followed by people comforting one another, and then to be, you know, positioned directly across from the courthouse and to be surrounded by police vehicles. You know, many of these objects or symbols are kind of are symbolic of the larger processes that kind of went on in the case. So it is striking to be simultaneously honoring Colton Bushy, but also being surrounded by such a heavy, punitive kind of system as well. It was quite striking.
Strikes me just now, and this is not to undercut your point in any way, Dallas, but the notion that what happens when intellectuals protest is that you get this very intense self-reflection that's also happening at the same time. It's just one of those weird things that we do when we're analyzing every dang thing that we do, and even when we're protesting and doing something incredibly embodied, or we're being embodied sites of resistance.
Yeah, I think that also what the protests allowed many of us to do, I think, was to actually, you know, express this grief and rage.
Yeah.
So I think that I am, and you know, I am in academia, and I spend too much of my time, I would say, thinking about stuff. It did allow space to actually just feel things and to embody, sort of feel this kind of, you know, a whole variety of or litany of feelings. But it was hard not to notice, just in a sort of sensory way. I know the presumption is, or the way it's framed, is that the police are there to kind of, you know, make sure the progression of peoples can flow in a way that's uninterrupted and, you know, is safe from potentially some sort of violent incursion from people that might not support what this protest is about. But it still is quite striking to see, I think for Indigenous peoples in general, and I don't want to, you know, overgeneralize here, but seeing, you know, police officers sometimes can be a very triggering or sort of can cause a variety of emotions to kind of manifest themselves. So I was also very much impressed by the sheer will of everybody to just focus their attention on what this march was about and, yeah, really express a solidarity with and a grief about this trial and this verdict.
Yeah, absolutely. This is At the Edge of Canada with TJ Phillips, Dallas Hunt in studio, one of the newest faculty members in the Department of Native Studies here at the University of Manitoba. We're talking about Colton Bushy and the acquittal of Gerald Stanley that sent a ripple and a shockwave through the Indigenous community here in Canada, or the country we call Canada. The feeling, though, is that there was a ton of apprehension. And as we dig into the back half an hour, as I said, your campus today being preempted so we can have a little bit of space to talk about this trial and this verdict, is that when this dropped on Friday night and we were all doing our different things, I was on the air calling hockey, you were at a hockey game, some people were at weddings, as much anger, immediate visceral anger that we had at seeing that he got off, there was still a huge dose of cynicism from Indigenous folks knowing that he probably was going to get off. And that, I think, ran through every response that I saw after the verdict came down. Having said that, the visceral response to seeing it from me, I felt stunned. And I felt like, I felt a kind of grief and a kind of stunning that only happens when you feel like something outside of your control just happened to you, like a death or a sickness or something. It felt in that register when the state conspired to acquit this man of murdering this Indigenous youth. And my whole body just rebelled against this notion that I was supposed to feel like justice was served, and I could only feel the opposite. I could only imagine what it felt like for members of the family, of which my heart immediately leapt out towards, and I felt incredibly sad for them and was immediately praying for them. Is that what happened for you too? I'm not alone in this. This wasn't some like Benedict Anderson like imagined community of grief. This was a literal thing that happened to everybody.
Yeah, I think everybody immediately felt the weight of this. And you're right, I think there was a lot of cynicism beforehand, but I don't think that affected in any way anybody's support of the family and the family's, search for justice. It is a strange kind of phenomenon to sort of appeal to the very systems that seem to be inflicting violence upon you, right? So, but unfortunately, those are the mechanisms that we have at our disposal right now. I mean, there has been a campaign historically to make things like Indigenous law, perish or cease to exist. And while I don't think that has totally succeeded, it isn't the sort of dominant paradigm of how we, administer justice between each other and people that we have relations to, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. So what I will say is I too felt the weight. I will admit, one of those cynical people who, while I didn't necessarily think that Stanley would be acquitted, I thought there would at least be a manslaughter charge or something.
Yeah.
So when there was just a complete lack of anything resembling justice, I was at a loss for words, similar to you. So
yeah. So let's dig into the absolute. What's the word we've been using? The what's the? It was press with a P.
The
preposterity. How preposterous the defense,
right,
of Gerald Stanley was. So he was acquitted of second-degree murder, and they never even talked about manslaughter. I borrow how preposterous the defense was of Gerald Stanley from Hayden King's Twitter, who brought it up right after the event. He's how ridiculous, and Robert Drago talked about this in his Canada Land article, how incredibly, how implausible the hanging fire, the hang fire defense, the magic bullet theory that this gun just went off. So for any of you who don't know the details and the nuts and bolts of this case, essentially what the defense alleged of Gerald Stanley is that he shot a old Russian handgun into the air to scare away the youth who had pulled onto his property looking for help with a flat. There was accusations and allegations that they tried to steal an ATV. Gerald Stanley fired into the air with this handgun that he retrieved from his shed. He shot two fires into the air, and then he went to the SUV where Colton Bushy was in. He tried to pull the keys out of the car, and at the time that he was doing that with his left hand, the gun magically went off. And Bushy was killed execution style, as was described in the trial, with a bullet wound to the back of his head. The defense claimed that it was a hang fire, that due to an unclean gun, an old gun, bad ammunition, that a bullet hung in the chamber and just miraculously went off. Nobody pulled the trigger. He didn't aim to shoot him. It just happened. Now, what's missing in this defense, Dallas, is no claim of self-defense, despite there being allusions and language to, you know, keeping your property and protecting your property. But also what's in this is no claim of self-defense. What happened here was a complete accident. There was no intention to shoot him. How did that create reasonable doubt in an all-white jury? How does that create reasonable doubt for an acquittal in a situation that seems like, at the very least, this is careless use of a firearm, that this is manslaughter, that in some way Gerald Stanley is on the hook for the death of Colton? Explain that to me, because I think that's what we're all wondering, is how do we get to this point?
Yeah, I mean, the sheer amount of conflicting testimony, it seemed, and reasons or justifications for the murder of Colton Bushy provided during the trial were kind of flabbergasting in what was being proposed. So the way I tried to understand it was that I guess the claim was that it was an accidental misfire or hang fire. I believe the defense at one point wanted to use a Reddit thread to somehow prove that, which was also ridiculous. So it's a misfire, it's an accident, that was described as an execution style, you know, murder. Simultaneously, you had the defense, I think, really working very hard to conjure up a lot of imagery and cultivate a sort of sense of fear around all of the events that went on that day. The defense said that it was Gerald Stanley's castle, and that, you know, wouldn't you want to protect your castle? I mean, a castle already is kind of loaded, especially in a place like Battleford, with all this sort of fraught historical colonial imagery. And then just to really focus in on how frightened Gerald Stanley mm-hmm. was, right? So you simultaneously outline, or what sounded like to me, a sort of outline of the reasons he would potentially murder this indigenous youth, which is his fear, the protection of his property, his castle. And yet it's also described as an accident, a misfire or a hang fire. So you simultaneously sort of have the defense, at least I feel, sort of providing a dog's breakfast of like excuses, right? Mm-hmm. It was a misfire, but it was also potentially self-defense, or if we're not going to say something like that explicitly, we're certainly going to apply it to the language we use and through the imagery that we're going to sort of deploy for this kind of for this defense. I think that it was an appeal made to an all-white jury, and I think the defense asked the all-white jury to put themselves in Jerry's boots, or whatever the phrase it was that they used, to feel this sense of fear, to make it palpable, and to make it seem as though he was justified in what was apparently an accidental fire. It is so flabbergasting and sort of overwhelming, because to me a lot of it doesn't actually kind of add up or make sense, and not to mention the sort of conflicting testimony between Stanley and his son and how this is all complicates matters entirely. It also sounded mm-hmm. like Gerald Stanley had four arms or something. He was able to do a variety of things in a matter of seconds, basically. Yeah, I was stunned when I was listening to that kind of to that testimony.
Mm-hmm. And I think Hayden King's tweet and the way that you articulated it right there, this notion that it's flabbergasting, that it's stunning, that how can we invite reasonable doubt into this explanation when the only thing I doubt is the explanation itself? There's nothing inherently compelling about the defense painted as the picture in response. And what's feeding this as we continue to move back, now that we've addressed the verdict, go back to pretrial and the selection of the jury. And Stanley's defense counsel challenging every Indigenous candidate for the trial, creating an all-white jury where we can presume now that a group mentality or some kind of non-factor in that jury deliberation that only lasted for about, I think it was like 19 hours or something, that there was nobody in there with a dissenting voice that said, no matter what happens when people come into your property, you cannot murder somebody. That is not that never happened. Or at least we don't know if it did. It certainly doesn't show that there was any consolidation or cohesion in that jury to suggest that you couldn't murder an Indigenous youth. The idea being here is that the flawed system in which Canadian courts allow jury selection. There's a couple items there. One, Indigenous folks not being able to get down to the Battlefords to appear to be adjudicated to be on jury duty. The challenge is constantly from the defense. And talking us through that in the way it relates to some of the issues in the United States and how they have a different system of electing juries. Senator Murray Sinclair spoke about what we need to do in Canada to allow for a better representation on jury duty. This is just another example of the way in which the colonial Canadian court it certainly manifests itself over years and years and years to stack the deck against Indigenous folks.
Yeah, I think I was reading or I had heard, and the statistic or fact might be off, but I think I heard it a few times, was that I think the Indigenous population within Saskatchewan is something around 10%, say. And obviously this is concentrated higher in different places geographically across the province. There's going to be more Indigenous people up north, et cetera. But all that aside, if Indigenous peoples are at least a significant portion of the population in Saskatchewan, you would think then that there would be some representation by an Indigenous person on that jury. And yet what the defense did was basically dismiss anyone that they thought might possibly be would disadvantage their client, I guess, in any way. So it's not only is that immediately problematic, obviously, because there is no representation, but then I resent or kind of reject the notion that a jury full of Indigenous peoples would be any more racist or biased than, you know, I think the overwhelming idea was that if there was Indigenous people on there, they would be racist or, sorry, I shouldn't be using racist, prejudiced or biased against Stanley. And yet you have an all-white jury that then basically more or less condones or sees Stanley and his defense as providing a justifiable reason for the murder of Colton. So you have this interesting or problematic, might be a better word, kind of reversal here where, for whatever reason, an all-white jury is unbiased, right? It's objective. It is going to be rational, etc. And Indigenous peoples do not have this capacity. I think this is the sort of prevailing or sort of underlying sort of ideology at play here, right, by the defense and by the Canadian justice system in general, that to have Indigenous bodies on the jury would just, they couldn't allow justice to be served in a way that would be equitable, that would be, you know, in keeping with how the Canadian courts like to conduct themselves. And what I think this does is it sort of naturalizes and normalizes whiteness as not only how it takes up space and what spaces are accorded to it, but also the ability in which it can make enormous kind of decisions or conclusions about things that have very direct material effects on indigenous people.
Yeah. This is Dallas Hunt on At the Edge of Canada. I'm TJ Phillips. We have an extended live and studio version to talk about the Gerald Stanley acquittal and the continued outreach and attempts for justice for Colton Bushy. This situation isn't new in the history of Saskatchewan and Indigenous and non-Indigenous relations on the prairies. In particular, Peter Zosky article in Maclean's from 1963 got a lot of run on Twitter yesterday. Folks responding to it. Ian Mosby had a Twitter essay responding directly to this. The idea that, Zosky's article was around the murder of Alan Thomas, an Indigenous man in Saskatchewan, by a group of non-Indigenous folks who were all acquitted of the murder. And Zosky's, though it was problematically written, attempted to dive into what the state of race relations is in the Battlefords and in the Central West territory of Treaty 6 in Saskatchewan. There was a big push on Twitter, I felt like, from the Indigenous commenters on Twitter to reject the idea or reject the articulation and representation of Saskatchewan as the Mississippi of Canada or Southern United States in the 50s playing itself out in Canada, when in fact this is actually what happened over the weekend. This is Canada Indigenous state relations since contact. The violence of the colonial system, the segregation of Indigenous populations, the past system, the Indian Act, residential school, Indian hospitals, you name it, the removal of Indigenous folks from Canadian mainstream society on the prairies, the arming of farmers, the arming of settlers. And it was all summed up in one very pithy tweet, really smart tweet, by Leonard Sumner that said, they built the jails for us, they built the courts for them. And give us your sense of this, what I think you would say is the manifestation of colonial violence over time, how this is yet another example of that manifestation of colonial violence over time. This isn't new, this isn't isolated, this isn't the specter of Mississippi in the 50s. This is the lived reality of Saskatchewan right now today in 2018.
Yeah, I think that the comparisons with what happens to black lives and black bodies in the U.S., while I think sometimes there might be productive comparisons there, I am hesitant to sort of conflate these experiences, and I think a lot of people are speaking to this, that we shouldn't actually. There are multiple contexts going on and operating simultaneously, and I'm much more interested in listening to black people's in solidarity and to see, how we are all affected by these violent systems, whether it's colonialism or the transatlantic slave trade, the sort of histories of these systems that are very much present today. Yet I think sometimes there is a movement that happens a little too quickly that sort of, collapses all the differences and contexts that are operating at the same time. But what I would say about, so I too heard that's read the Sumner tweet, Leonard's tweet. They made the laws to protect themselves. They made the jails for us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that you see this playing out not only historically, but obviously in a contemporary sense with, Gerald Stanley being acquitted and not facing anything resembling a sort of kind of what could be articulated as justice. You see this with the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples in the prison population right now. I think I read somewhere that it's upwards to 80% in Saskatchewan. So you see this in very material bodily ways, in the ways in which certain people are allowed or overrepresented in particular spaces. But yeah, I think you're right to bring up that history of residential schools, of the clearing of Saskatchewan for settlement, of the pass system, which is really what the resonances of the past system in this case, I don't think can be ignored either. It's indigenous youth were not in the spaces that are accorded to them in certain settler imaginaries. So therefore, by virtue of not being in those spaces, some sort of punitive action is going to occur. And in this instance, it is a extreme physical violence. And all of these things are operating, you know, simultaneously. This is what kind of settler colonialism does, right? It eliminates to replace. So what it does is it attempts to eliminate indigenous bodies, indigenous cultures, politics, by whatever means necessary. And then it seeks to replace this with, you know, another sort of order or regime, right? In this case, it would be a sort of settler colonial regime. So in that way, settler colonialism is productive in the sense that it produces another legal ordering. So in this is how we see a system that allows someone like Gerald Stanley manifest itself, right? It's most definitely tied to these histories of displacement, dispossession, starvation, all of the things that not only moved bodies across space, but attempted to eradicate bodies within those spaces entirely. And the way this manifests itself with Colton Bushi and the other indigenous youth being present in that space is things that we've seen historically, which is when indigenous peoples enter spaces that in settler imaginaries they are not supposed to be in, they are met with overwhelming violence.
And that's, I want to tease this out just a little bit. The way that you said when indigenous youth are not in the space that the settler imaginary accords to them, what is the idealized settler space or imagined space for indigenous people? I mean, I think that's a tough question because I think the answer is in some ways horrific. It's also in some ways strategic. And in also another way, it's assimilative and it's also an ordering. It's its own ordering of space. So when we think of what were the trespasses, the Canadian court system likes to suggest to us that the first and most primary trespass was that into Stanley's property. That is the most literal example of that trespass. But in the settler imaginary, phantasmatically, where have indigenous bodies actually trespassed here?
Yeah, I think that when you mention the idealized sort of site or space that settlers or that settler imaginary might accord for indigenous populations or peoples, I think that ideally for settlers and what the history of settler colonialism has sort of indicated to everyone is that the idealized space would be in the ground for indigenous peoples not to exist entirely, right? That said, I think that the sort of trespasses that happened here, I think it's ridiculous for indigenous youth and indigenous peoples from Saskatchewan to feel like they're trespassing on any lands that historically have been their ancestral homelands, right? So the logic that it was Gerald Stanley's castle and therefore he has to keep the, you know, hordes at bay that are trying to scaffold or get over his, you know, castle wall. So that whole imagery that it evokes, I think, is incredibly problematic because it doesn't account for the fact that Gerald Stanley's castle is on indigenous lands, right? And these lands are acquired through a variety of means, whether it's outright dispossession and displacement, whether it is through what is supposed to be the shared tenure of lands through treaty or something like that, sort of. But, yeah, in this sense, what these indigenous youth did was they entered into private property, which, again, doesn't accord with how indigenous peoples may perceive of this land, right? But this is certainly how the defense framed it and how Stanley undoubtedly thought about it at the time. And therefore, this, for whatever reason, warrants immediate violence or their death. So the trespassing here is happening not only in a physical or bodily sense, in that these indigenous youths are going into a space that by all means is their territory and they should have access to, since historically it's indigenous lands, and being met with this violence from Stanley. But they're also crossing a sort of imaginary, right? They're entering into a place where it would be inconceivable to see them there, meaning this is my private property, you know, get off my land, get out of my castle. And this happens all over Canada, right? And it's happened, it actually doesn't, the context, whether it's rural or urban, it always seems as though Indigenous peoples are in too many spaces or taking up too much space, always, to a sort of settler colonial imaginary. And so, yeah, the crime, as far as I can see it, that Stanley and the defense may have sort of conjured up, that the youth were doing that day, Indigenous youth, was simply existing in spaces that historically they've been allowed to exist in, but in the contemporary moment that is framed by all these sort of settler colonial mechanisms and regimes, they should not have been in because of these sort of colonial logics.
I like the way that you unpack that in terms of colonial logics, because what this case ultimately did, whether it's to the meta-narrative of settler colonialism and biopolitics, or the literal trespassing of indigenous folks into private property, and I'm using square quotes on the radio, to the hang fire and the magic bullet theory, the introduction of reasonable doubt and the plausibility of an implausible action, to the actions in the street to disrupt Canadian mainstream society, to let them know that we're not okay. And then the analysis and the intellectualizing now today and what's happening over the weekend all seeks to go back to the same essential point, that we're being distracted from the fact that an Indigenous youth was shot and nobody is going to receive a punishment for that. So even with the means that are open to us to seek justice, they are wholly inadequate in providing necessary action in a situation that is so uncomplicatedly disastrous and tragic for Colton Bushy's family. So I think that I appreciate you coming on the show today. Before we go, I'll get you out of here on this. What's next? I know that there's formal appellate processes, they can appeal, or the province can appeal on behalf of the family. There will be more actions. I know that most of Indigenous Canada is waiting with bated breath to see what happens in the Raymond Cormier trial and the death of Tina Fontaine, which could be another disastrous blow if he's acquitted. What is next for the solidified and cohesive community for Indigenous folks in Canada? What are we going to do next?
Well, I think there's a variety of things that can be done. So I read today that members of Colton Bushy's or Bushy's family are currently in Ottawa and discussing with ministers there what a sort of reconceptualized justice system might look like. I'm not going to speculate as to what that might look like. But I know that that's what the family is currently doing. For others, Indigenous communities and peoples, you know, across what is currently Canada and the U.S., I think that there's going to be a lot of reflection, a lot of rage, a lot of writing, a lot of communing, and just really trying to parse out what exactly happened and what are the logics that allow these things to happen. And as you mentioned with Tina Fontaine, allow them to continually happen. Why do people, how are people allowed to take the lives of Indigenous youth, and how can a state deem this as either justifiable or just okay in a sort of everyday material way? I look forward to the immense amount of creative and critical work that Indigenous scholars, Indigenous communities are going to do around this issue, the writing that's going to be done, the thinking, the sharing of grief. I think that this is going to be, it's certainly going to alter the landscape in a way that is going to allow for all sorts of sites of hopefully generative change. I also hope too that Indigenous peoples, you know, continue to live their life and to feel joy, because this system so routinely disallows us or prohibits that joy or punishes us for this joy. So I hope that Indigenous youth will be able to, you know, go for a swim and go into lands that are historically their ancestral homelands, and to just not fear the threat of violence and immediate violence. So I know what I'll be doing personally is we'll continue to write about it, and I will speak with my students or the students in my classes about it, and just continue to hopefully be a site of support for not only Indigenous peoples across or throughout what is currently Canada, but also for, you know, Colton Bushi's relatives as well. I know Jade a little bit, and I know, you know, some of the other people involved in this. And so I want to send them all my support and love. And
yeah, well said. And that goes up for me too. Nothing but love for the Baptiste, the Tatouses, the Bushis. We're with you. We're thinking about you, and we're fighting with you and for you on this as you continue to fight against a system that was rigged from the start. If you haven't seen the video yet of Colton Bushi, of Gerald Stanley being escorted out of the courtroom after the verdict was read, it's been flooding through Twitter, flooding through social media. The cries of disbelief and of anguish from his mom, devastating and heartbreaking to listen into and watch to. But a juror ran out. Gerald Stanley was rushed out by police. And I was saying this to Dallas yesterday when we were prepping for the show. That is the physical embodiment of getting away with murder in Canada. That's exactly what it looks like as the cops run you out of the courtroom.
It certainly looked that way.
Certainly looked that way. Dallas, for all you do in Indigenous literature research, Indigenous activism, actions, supporting the revitalization of Indigenous languages, working with Indigenous youth, Indigenous pedagogies, and representing Treaty 8 and your home so proudly. Thank you, and thank you for coming on.
Hi, Hexa, thank you.
We are, this was an extra extended version of At the Edge of Canada that Dallas was happy to join us on. Appreciate you tuning in. Again, the fight continues, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to At the Edge of Canada. At the Edge of Canada is recorded at the UMFM studios. It's on the traditional Treaty 1 territory of the Anishinaabeg, the Cree, the Oji Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene people in the homeland of the Métis Nation. We'll be back next week with more check-ins with all the major players in the Indigenous intellectual community. Thanks, everybody, and you can catch me on Twitter at TFillers. I went and stuck my neck out there. I went and laid down my head. And then I wished I had some.
Winnipeg. You're listening to CJUM 101.5 FM, your hit-free radio station.
We'll be right back.